for our conversation this morning, I'd like to start with case 16 from the Woman Block. The case. Yun Min said, "See how vast and wide the world is. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell?" And he gives a little sermon. All you Zen students training in the way, don't be victimized by sounds. Don't follow up on forms. You may have realization on hearing a sound or enlightenment on seeing a form. That's natural. But don't you know that true Zen students can ride sounds and veil forms? They see all and sundry clearly. They handle each and everything deftly. Perhaps you are such a person. But tell me, does the sound come to the ear, or does the ear go to the sound? And if you have transcended sound and silence, what do you say to such a point? If you listen with your ear, it is hard to understand. If you hear with your eye, you're intimate at last. And then in an orgy of joy, he sings a song. With realization, all things are one family. Without realization, all things are disconnected. Without realization, all things are one family. With realization, all things are disconnected. So I would like to start by rehearsing just a little bit the history of ordination within the Zen way. David touched on it succinctly, and I'd like to just add a little tiny bit here. As most all of us know, that the Buddha, Gautama Siddhartha, gathered friends with him, first men and later women. When the Sangha first gathered, there was a matrix of monastic ordination that belonged to the proto-Hindu culture, but there were no rules. The rules followed actions. Somebody did something, and they said, "I think we're going to have a rule." And it blossomed up to several hundred observations, many which were considered major, others which might have been considered minor, though no one was quite clear which might be which. In fact, when the Buddha died, he said, as he was on his deathbed or in that general neighborhood, that really, just keep the major ones. Don't worry about the little ones. And after he died, nobody could agree which were the major ones and which were the minor ones. So the Vinaya monasticism that emerged during his lifetime continues in just a couple of very minor recensions throughout most of the Buddhist world. There are some small exceptions in Tibet with ordained clergy that are not in the Vinaya, but generally speaking, until Japan, Vinaya ordination was the normative way of practicing Buddhism within within rule. You were a layperson, or you were a monk, or a nun. Then in Japan, a series of historical accidents. The first had to do with the evolution of ordination platforms. People could only ordain in certain circumstances at specially consecrated places, and additionally the imperial courts had a certain say in how that was going to be done. In Japan, some of the older sects controlled the ordination platforms, and they really didn't like the new competition coming along and really restricted how they could ordain. Finally, one of the Tendai leaders petitioned the imperial court to allow a new ordination platform, but not to use Vinaya vows, but rather vows that came out of China through a text called the Brahmachala, or the Brahmanet Sutra. And shortly after he died, the bureaucracies always are slow, that was authorized. And quickly in Japan, the ordination model became this bodhisattva ordination. Initially, the intention was to be exactly the same as Vinaya monasticism. They were nuns and monks, celibate and under deep rule. But the texts themselves were more ambiguous and more open to interpretation. And from the beginning, one of the Jodo Shinshu, the founder of the Jodo Shinshu sect, Shinran Shonen, said, you know, this the celibacy isn't necessary to this rule. And he married openly. In the Zen schools, this didn't happen quite so quickly, but the model of training took people from monastic training into temples where there'd be one or at most two monks in residence in thousands upon thousands of temples. And this led to a long period where informal liaisons were formed. And all of a sudden these boys would be sent off to the monasteries for training with somewhat uncertain parentage. And finally, in the beginning of the Meiji, in the middle of the 19th century, there were a series of reforms, and there are various reasons for that. But they finally acknowledged realities and eating meat, growing hair, and marrying became lawful for people under ordination rules. And when Zen came to the United States, first initially mostly through Japan, that's the ordination that we all encountered. The language was monastic, but the actions were priestly, ministerial, and it has been the birthing of many interesting things for us as we go forward in the last 50 odd years that Zen has really been taking root. It's in the 100 years, a little more, since Zen became an American Western practice. So, 45 years ago, I started practicing Zen, and I was a young person of no particular means and hardly any prospects. And I looked at the great Zen center that was forming in San Francisco and was very impressed by how cool everybody looked. And somewhere along the line, it occurred to me, if I ordained, I would be cool too. And maybe even all the various problems that beset me as a young person in the late 1960s in the San Francisco Bay Area would be fixed. And I'm not quite sure how I got this notion into my head. I really didn't know any of the priests. I sat in the Berkeley Zendo, and Mel Weitzman was the resident priest, and he seemed pretty cool and a lot distant. But there was an elegance and beauty to the way he conducted things, and I looked at what would that mean, and I saw San Francisco Zen Center, even in the late 1960s, had become something of a large institution, and my goodness, they expected things from people who wanted to ordain, and I thought that was a silly thing. And so I wasn't sure what to do next. I continued sitting, and then Jiu Kinnett, as many people know, came to America from Japan and announced that she was receiving students, and I became her first student here in America. Recently, a friend and mentor from that time sent me a number of photographs, and I have this the interesting picture of the first batch of ordinees, and with me standing there. I had to deduct which one was me from my elimination. But there's a kid with big ears and just a little bit of a half smirk on his face, and all my friends agreed that was me. I just can't project that far back, 45 plus years. What it was that what I was thinking and feeling and hoping at that time, I've built a story, but it's a story. It's the story of a 65-year-old man looking back at a 20-year-old boy. I launched into monastic life in the Japanese monastic style, and it was very important for me. There's a lot to be said for the close rule that we encounter in the traditional training system. But there were many wrong things with it as well. And as I moved forward, at some point it stopped working for me. And I left. And I had about a 10-year period where I think of it as wandering in the wilderness, where I tried on various things and none of them quite fit. And then I found for me this lovely, fortuitous joining together of Zen practice driven by koans, but within a lay context, and Unitarian Universalism as a spiritual community that filled most of the gaps that I felt I was encountering in the not really community of Zen practice that I belonged to. Things continued. I had a problematic relationship with my ordinations. I wasn't sure what to do with them. I had set my ropes aside. I knew there were ways to disrobe, but I never quite took the step to formally renounce the ordination vows. But for me, the practice had changed. The focus for me became koan introspection practice, retreat-driven, and the rest of the spiritual community was in Unitarian Universalism. This continued actually kind of satisfactorily for me for a lot of years. And finally, then John started authorizing me as a teacher. And I was serving the Unitarian Church in the suburbs of Phoenix when I began resuming teaching and at that point I began to feel some niggling, nagging thing about that there's something larger that I could be doing, but I didn't do anything particularly about it. Then we moved to the Boston area, and I began to very fully, in addition to leading the Unitarian religious community, stepping into the role as a Zen teacher. And many things came together, but there was one particular point that I thought was meaningful for me, particularly in this context. There was a time as I was proceeding along working on koans where I realized I could check anyone. Now, on the one hand, it was true. I could check anyone. On the other hand, that's a Zen sickness. When we're caught up in the idea of our clarity, we are in very dangerous ground. And I had already seen other Zen teachers who were unfettered and who were doing things that were damaging to people. They did not see themselves bound by anything but their own insight. And that did not work. I could see it not working. And that's when I began thinking back to my ordination. And the truth is, there's no magic involved. Ordination, as we saw on Friday night, or whatever it was, Saturday night, whatever, last year. It's simply these 16 promises and some gifts. And these are those vows that come out of the Brahmacharya Sutra. And they're exactly the same vows that we take when we receive the precepts in Jukai. And there is no difference. They are the same vows. And yet, there is a difference. The difference is subtle. It's human. A few years ago, I belonged to one of these listservs for Zen teachers, and only in America kind of thing. And a lay Zen teacher who was formerly a Jesuit priest was explaining the Christian ideas of ministry in the range and how in Catholicism the concept of ordination is called ontological, as opposed to most Protestant forms of ordination, which are called functional. And the difference is that in the ontological model, it is believed that through the rite of ordination, one's character is changed. The person becomes different in some manner. In the Protestant idea of ministry, the action is the ministry, and who the person is almost irrelevant. It's an act of ministry. You're a minister while you're doing ministry. And the weird turn for me was that any number of my Zen teaching colleagues who are ordained said, oh yeah, Zen ordination's ontological. It was causing me considerable consternation because I was wondering what part of them they thought had been changed. But that would have required an invitation to the Doksan room. I don't think any of them were interested in that. But I understand the temptation. You know, we get these fancy, cool robes. We cut our hair differently. There are small precedences that we have in our liturgical life. And there's this constant push to something. That something can be the aggrandizement of the ego. And often it is. And it can be something very powerful and compelling and useful. As I saw myself being aware of myself, knowing I could check anyone, I knew I was dangerous. And I knew I needed to bow to something more. And while the promises are exactly the same, with the exact same intention for each of us when we take up the vows of not killing and not lying and not stealing and not misusing our sexuality and the rest of them, when we ordain, we also take on a promise of belonging to a community of equals. that each of us has the right to call the rest of us into account, that we have made a commitment to this practice that's transcends even our awakening, even our ability to check others, even our greatest insight must be checked itself against how we relate to the rest of our community. And this is no pitch for ordination. It also, I think, in our community requires a particular movement of the heart to want to serve. And for me, that was a part of that service, is to be able to be checked. We all belong to the greater community when we take the precepts the first time. We belong to the greater community when our heart simply moves us in the direction to sit with each other and to keep coming back. But each time that we articulate that intention, there are changes in the heart. We are reorienting ourselves. We are committing ourselves to reorient again and again and again. Yunmin. One of those kind of wonderful things about this is we do belong to a family. Yunmin is not some distant teacher that we reference. Yunmin is a member of our family. And Yunmin, our great-great uncle, said, "See how vast and wide this world is. Why do you put on your 7-piece robe at the sound of the bell?" Any questions?
Thank you.
Sorry, that was a misstatement if I said that.
Oh.
I practiced with Jiu Kennett for about 3 years, and then 10 years in the wilderness.
Oh, I see. Maybe I misheard it, but my question was that you said when you met John, you said your practice started focusing on koans,
right,
and stuff like that. What was the focus of it before?
With Kennett Roshi was what we would call a pure Soto teacher. Practice was focused on Zazen, Shiken Taza, supported by meticulous attention to the form of it, of service. Not unlike San Francisco Zen Center or other communities that do not use koan introspection practice. Though I should add, in fairness, her primary teacher, Chisan Koho, was one of a small raft of Soto priests who did do some training in Rinzai communities. And I think there's some koanic experience in her background, in retrospect from now.
But is that practice helpful?
Which one?
Focusing on the forms and the service and the traditional.
I think it's a real practice. I think I think for all of us, we find different ways in. I think Zazen is the foundation of it all. I read recently Dosho commenting on how koan introspection teaches us how to do Zazen, and I think there's some truth to that. My baseline practice is sitting, and yet the sharpening and the focusing and is not unique to koan introspection practice, but more closely associated with it than without. I think I've said before, my experience, my observation of people who do the Zen, are in the Zen family but don't do koans, is often they get very wide and compassionate, but often also a little hazy. And the koan people, the danger for the koan people is to, you know, is to just be all about sharpness and clarity and you know, and the just this and missing sometimes the compassionate side of it. I hope Boundless Way fully appreciates both eyes.
James, I really appreciated hearing this journey, and there's a part I want to know more about. I mean, in a sense, we never step off the way. So, dharmically, what did the wilderness look like for you?
Dharmically?
Yeah.
Well, it was, I think, I had insights, experiences, pointings when I was with Geo Kinnett, and the way I formed it in my head was that I was, so how can I be a Western person who has these, you know, these insights? I think I was missing that I needed to continue the practice, and was, you know, even at that point thinking that maybe there was enough there. And so I was looking at my natal Christianity as a possibility, and I would look, but nothing quite worked. Geo Kinnett was friends with a crazed Western Sufi teacher, and I tried that for a little while because there had been connections, and that didn't work for me. Although this weird communist who found herself there in that Sufi community became my spouse.
So it's worth the detour.
But I just got my companion, and then we left. So does that? I think I was learning. I mean, I learned to appreciate the Christian mystics. I learned to appreciate Muslim mystics, and I realized that you know, at some point, you know, well, the only thing that really worked for me was the Zen thing. I just needed to reframe it in a way that or find a different frame of it that was suitable to my, you know, my personality and inclinations and needs, that could challenge me in a healthy way.
So, I mean, you were, from the sound of it, when you were practicing with John, mm-hmm. you were living elsewhere and then traveling.
That's correct.
And I guess there's two pieces of this. One is that the lack of community at that point for you, mm-hmm. that was filled with Unitarian. Do you see more of this model becoming that, and where do the priests fit into that for you?
Right. Well, now I was we lived in proximity for about 3 years. Yeah. So where I saw him multiple times a week. And then we moved down to Berkeley to go back to school, you know, and then life. And what I'm seeing emerging for us here we're in that period of 100 flowers, and all sorts of things are being tried. What I see the Boundless Way project as is all of us have practiced in this kind of retreat-driven model rather than monastery-driven model, where the intensive experiences, still need those intensive experiences, but you have them episodically, and that a larger life is expected of us. If you look at our ordination expectation, somebody has to have a way to make a living. You know, we require that. You either need to be in school or have a job, and if you want to ordain with us. And our project here, I think, is to see, well, how does that how does that emerge? And there are lots of ideas about that, but we're so much at the beginning of it. But Zen in the West, where priests are not or supported by the communities, even in the larger thing, we start starting to see patterns of how people, you know, psychology, counseling, work, that school teaching, these are jobs that have a little bit of wiggle room, so you can do this other work. Our kin, you know, in the West, therapy comes straight out of the priesthood. They just plucked off that part of the cure of souls and secularized it. There are any number of things that people can do, but at this moment, most people who practice are going to be self-supporting, and that becomes part of our practice. You know, how do we both fully engage in being bound to each other in a sorority fraternity of practice, and how do we exercise that little extra bit of independence that the financial autonomy has actually pluses as well as minuses. And we don't know. It looks like we're seeing the contours. I think the next phase is going to be, are there going to be a few self-sufficient temples? You know, what Karen and Jay are doing, where they have a temple that actually has a religious education program and people who want to support the, you know, a worshiping community rather as well as a practicing community, to make a distinction, I hope conveys some meaning. People who are moved by the Dharma and want it to be part of their lives, but are not going to take on this insane practice, but want their children to be raised with these values and concerns. Really interesting stuff going on. One experiment. Absolutely, they're continuing to be, and still the largest communities that continue are the ones that are dedicated to practice, and people come and leave. You know, Tassajara and Zen Mountain Center in California, that we're worried about getting burned down on our morning chants. Zen Mountain Monastery in New York. There's just tons. You know, there's a lot of this stuff going on. Mount Shasta. There's variants on the training monastery model that we inherited from Japan. And also, of course, we have the other groups. We have the Korean culture practice communities and the Chinese Chan communities, each giving different flavors to how it's coming together. Is that?
Well, and one of the, to me, interesting things about the way we're creating are these, the tracks of teaching and transmission, and the track of ordination service, sort of both parallel and related, but not the same. So in Boundless Way, there are recognitions around practice leader, Dharma teacher, senior Dharma teacher, and then eventually transmission in this teaching lineage. That in some way is totally dependent on the teachers. I mean, we recognize and confer those titles as we see it happening. The lovely thing about the priestly ordination as we're taking it is that it's really initiated from the person who takes it on as a particular relationship to the Sangha. Not dependent, I mean, yes, we expect priests to certain things, but there's also this desire to formalize a particular relationship, to devote one's life, that although there is an ordaining teacher, it's not essentially the teacher's decision. It's the decision, to me, of the ordinee. This is the public. This is a form that will allow me to express my heart and my devotion to this path. And it's not, of course, the only form. You can still be devoted to serving the Sangha and that don't feel called for whatever reason. There's certainly some mystery here. But it does feel to me like these two things create pathways for our hearts and pathways for both the transmission in the community and serving the community and the transmission of this that is beyond words and letters, that has no form but must appear in form.
And this is, I think, something very exciting that we're doing here, in that from Gautama Siddhartha's time into the 20th century, the soul, even though the idea, the story, the myth of transmission, it has nothing to do with ordination. It has to do with insight and trust. The carrier of this have been the ordained sangha, what's happened in the West, one of the great gifts of the West, and you begin to see a little bit in East Asia as well, is the acknowledgement of that implicit reality of, in acknowledging teachers who are not going to be ordained, and the here in the West we're quite caught up in that. John Tarrant's not ordained; he's a lay teacher. George Bowman is not ordained; he's a lay teacher. And these are very important teachers, you know, and that's part of the juice of the Western Dharma. But we're seeing there is a value for ordination. I mean, not as the carrier of the tradition, but as part of the tradition and a new manifestation. Not as the sole carrier of the tradition, but as a manifestation. First, for me, it was like holding myself to account, and then it seemed also, then it became obvious that it was about an intentionality of service. And then I would have to ask you guys, you know, each of you, why it is that, you know, you're ordained. And I suspect the stories or some of the language be the same, but I bet you each story is a little, as David was saying, you know, a little different. Go for it.
So when you were 20, you wanted to put on a seven-piece robe to look cool. Now why do you put it on?
Because I'm not cool.
It's pretty dorky, actually.
Pretty dorky, yeah. The truth is.
I think
you're cool. Oh, suck up.
I always liked you best.
Okay, some others over here. How about Steve, Jeremy, and then Paul?
So are we saying that if someone in this community feels called to service, that they should be a priest?
Not necessarily.
We've established these two paths.
Yeah. No, there's no should in this. I think if you feel like you're called to be a priest, you'd want to talk about it with us and then clarify that. But we can be lay people, we can be priests, we can do whatever we want. We can come to Sesshin, not come to Sesshin, go to practice, not come to practice. All of that, I think that's what David was pointing to. You know, this is something that we can, for ourselves, make these decisions, which are different kinds of decisions than becoming a teacher, a Dharma teacher, a senior Dharma teacher, receiving transmission. That's something that the teachers are holding. But so it's an option. It's like there's a door that's open in our way.
And I think just really important to underscore, you can serve in any number of ways. Mm-hmm. This is a way of service, you know. And it's an ancient way of service. It's functional, though. We don't do the ontological thing. It's functional. You're serving because you're serving.
Well, I would also say there's an ontological part of it. Yeah. I think that might be when the heart turns I think that I don't think putting on the robes is the ontological action. I think there's something that turns inwardly that sometimes could manifest as being a priest. So I know for me it was both, that they blend. I can't even separate ontology and function. There's something beyond those two categories, but it's helpful to hear about the two categories because there are elements of both for me. And I think everyone needs to look at that. There are priests in boundless ways and who will never ordain. Their life is already purely service. I feel like I'm looking at one now. And you might ordain, who knows? But you don't need to. There's no should.
And I think there is something that's sort of clarifying and fuzzy at the same time that started in Japan, well, actually started with the Buddha, but this lay versus monk, ordained versus not ordained. So all of us who have taken Jukai have ordained in the sense of receiving, as you said, these same precepts. So priests are not different in that way. This is not a class set aside in some special way. And yet, so this Vimalakirti, you know, this lay person who, with this great wisdom. So what it means to be lay and ordained is not really clear, I think, given the way we are saying we're ordained living in the world. There's certainly people who would say, from the vast majority of Buddhism, well, you're not really priests. You know, you're clearly not ordained if you're not living in a monastery or haven't taken the 200 vows. So there's some creative trying to find some juice, trying to work with on the level of form with these ancient traditions, not by trying to imagine we know what other people meant, but by living into them. And a great story George tells sometimes about Sun Sanin, that after he had ordained, he had created a category he called Bodhisattva priest, which was different from what he inherited in Korea, which is pure Vinaya. So in Korea, if you're going to be a monk, it's the 200 and celibacy and all of that. And so he created this new category, and people said, you know, what does it mean? This being a priest, of course, this is after they'd already received it. And so, you know, so what does it mean? So,
part of our inheritance.
Right. So he said, "Well, let's have a meeting, and you know, I'll explain." And so he gathered everyone in a circle. He said, "So you want to know what it means?" He said, "Look around this room," and then he left. And they all went running after him. No. Zen trick. But anyway, it is this call. Yeah. Jeremy and then Paul.
So one of the things that I think about a lot, especially as priests begin to emerge as more of a part of Boundless Way, is the way it creates two classes of citizen in the community. And it's something that I've experienced firsthand in other communities. And I've practiced in sanghas where there have been priests, and some of those have been very, very good, very service-oriented priests. And I've also seen some be horribly abusive in pretty much every way you can imagine. And I've also practiced in communities which do not ordain, period, for precisely those reasons. And, you know, there's a lot of talk, and there was a lot of talk at, for example, the priest workshop last weekend, about how it's not really a special thing, and how it's a life of service, and, you know, if anything, it's actually sort of underneath. It's a step down in a service orientation to the larger community. And I like that idea. And I also don't think that it always holds up to analysis, because only priests get to march in the procession. and only priests wear robes. And there are all of these subtle distinctions that talk about it and construct it however you want. They're special. And I don't know that that's much of a question, but this is something I spend a lot of time thinking about. So I don't know if there's anything you guys can say.
Yeah, I have something to say. And I think we have these kind of very interesting dynamics in our culture. You know, we want everything equal, except me. And so there's a constant, you know, there is a constant tension. I mean, any time that we do set up something that any kind of distinction, there's somebody's going to be pissed off. You know, and it's dangerous. And life's dangerous. My observation of the communities that don't have ranks and titles is they're the most intractable. You know, the person in charge is never deposed because there's nothing to hook onto to challenge. So, you know, human dynamics, I think it's better for us, generally speaking, to acknowledge these human qualities and then engage them in the most humble way we can and be open to being challenged. And we'll see what happens. Yeah, I think that.
I'm really glad you brought this up, Jeremy, yeah, because I'm sure it's in the minds of lots of people.
Sure.
And as you were speaking, I got a little distracted by whoever just walked in the door with their high heels. But so I heard most of what you were saying. But anyway, so I see this manifesting everywhere in Boundless Way. I see that there are men and there are women. I see that there are people who are doing koan practice and people who are doing shikan taza. And even though we're not supposed to talk about what happens in Doksan, I'm sure we do. Because we did in all the communities I've ever been part of, even though there is that guideline. There are people who have long Doksans and people who have short Doksans. I mean, we tell ourselves stories about what that means. So for me, I think we're just, you know, David said in a Dharma talk, I don't know when it was, sometime at the temple recently, that the purpose of Zen is to stir everything up, you know, to make things more confusing. So in a way, you know, that is part of what we're doing here in Boundless Way. We've got three lineage streams blending together. None of them, by the way, Dominic, helpful, I don't think, at least in the way I understand helpful. You know, not shikan taza is not helpful. Koan practice is not helpful. Being a priest. There's something else we're doing here. We're coming to the fundamental matter, what it means to be a human being. So just having that feeling of, I don't like this, I'm uncomfortable, that's a practice point and really valuable to name and be met and not talked out of. So I really bow you for that. Thank you.
And I want to say we've been talking to Ray for a long time. So that will continue.
Wait, that was the other thought. Look at these people.
But I want to say, too, that I guess following up on what James was saying, that when human beings come together, rank appears. Mm-hmm. And my experience is the same. Any group that says it's egalitarian is more difficult to enter because there are, so yeah, when Jeremy speaks, well, we do what he says, but when David speaks, everybody knows that you just let him speak and go on. You know, there are rules like that. So to try to be as explicit as we can, so there are, and again, so not just priest, not priest, Dharma teacher, not Dharma teacher.
Right, right.
Senior Dharma, you know, so I think the challenge for us as humans is to acknowledge both that there are people that are more experienced and less experienced, and that there's a fundamental equality that shoots through it all, and we can fall in one way or the other. To say we're all the same is not true and sort of washes everything out, but I think and I hope in our community we keep this dynamic balance, so we're watching because we are exactly prone to what every other human community is prone to. Well, I'm special, but you can't say that I'm special because that's wrong, right? So to acknowledge, hey, there is something going on here, And that's part of this disturbance we call Boundless Way.
The disturbance in the great disturbance. Boundless disturbance.
And can I just express my gratitude for the fact that this is the only community I've ever encountered where, of either type, that this can be discussed openly?
Yeah.
And I think that's, as you said, this is innate to the human condition. What else can we do except be as open about it and talk about it? So thank you, all three,
thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank you.
So Paul and then Jay.
So, James, I really appreciate your big picture by bringing in some of the details and with your personal story. And one part of it that interests me, and it was brought up early on, was the wilderness. And in this case, you know, reading as far as about our ancient Chinese ancestors, Ferguson, this idea of pilgrimage, this idea of wilderness, this idea of moving around from teacher to teacher. Part of me, there's like this this longing that, you know, maybe I should mix it up out there and do those things. And then there's part of me, I can't imagine leaving Lasende inside that's there. And I think, you know, for me, is I think part of this is that I've been on this pilgrimage. I'm actually still on it. I am in the wilderness that's here. There's this particular pilgrimage in India, this pilgrimage of Braj, which is, as far as a Krishna pilgrimage, and it's circular. So you end right where you begin. That's in there. And I feel that, you know, in this case, this pilgrimage that I'm on, this wilderness that I'm in, it's every day. It really is. It's not just simply this kind of distance that's moved in a physical sense. I think for me, one of the benefits that I have in this community is that it's a circular pilgrimage that I get to come back. Or in this case, maybe to change, I choose to come back. And so this is part of my development that's here. And so, you know, lovely to hear about, you know, the as far as California, Arizona, here, that's there, and you know, I can quickly fill in as far as where I've been, and who knows where I'm going to go. That's there, and somehow always having this pilgrimage, this within me, having this community as far as within me. So.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Jay?
It's been occurring to me to share that James and Dawn and myself earlier this summer went to a conference of teachers that are not just Zen teachers, but the Mahasangha, people in the Theravada tradition, the Tibetan tradition, people working very assiduously with secular approaches and things. And just to say that this question of ordained and not ordained is not just a Zen thing. The whole Mahasangha in the Western Hemisphere is working this through, and it's alive. It's a live edge for a lot of folks. And simply to say that what's happening here in this community is very noticed, not just by ourselves, but I mean actually the weight of the practice that's happening here is having an effect on how younger folks who would inherit the Tibetan lineage look at what they do. Folks who are in the Theravada tradition, they're going, you guys do it how? That's really interesting. And for the constraints and gifts that we have, our larger Mahasangha brothers and sisters have different sets of gifts and constraints. And all of this is together going someplace. I don't really know where.
It's paddling that round boat.
I just have to say, you know, well, all of that said and all these conversations had, one of the big safety nuts that comes here is this conversation.
Yeah.
The fact of the conversation is one of the saving graces. And to me, the robe, the not robe, the koan, all of this is made
real and really open in this conversation. And I'm just so grateful that it's happening.
I'm so happy to hear about that. That was James Cordova, and Dawn is also known as Karen. One of the things that's happening in Boundless Way, we've announced this informally, we haven't made the formal announcement, is that the next person is going to receive the first part of transmission is James Cordova, who's not a priest. And so this is something that's really important for Boundless Way, that we don't tie the two things together. If you want to be a teacher, you think the road is through being a priest. It's not. It is something that we're engaging with all the time. Each person in the room here and in our Mahasangha is seen individually for all their gifts. And as you say, all the traditions have gifts. And I'm thinking that all the people here have gifts. Every single one of us, every single one of you, is so important to making the Sangha happen. And so we get different roles and different permissions. But we'll be now, we'll have a Dharma holder who's not ordained. And that'll be cool in its own way. And dorky.
Don't talk about James. Though,
right? Yeah. So this is an ongoing exploration. This is like this. And I think that's what you're pointing to, Jay, and that's what Jeremy's pointing to. An open wondering, which is also to me what practice is. What is this? Who are you?
So, Julie.
Thinking about the ordination service and taking the same precepts that we've taken in Jukai again, but then getting these robes and the bald head. reminded me of it's short, a story from my past. When I was in my early 20s, I was working in a job that was related to the Minnesota Council of Churches. And the Minnesota Council of Churches had a booth at the state fair, and I went and stood at the booth for a while. And a minister who was also working at the booth had been walking around and came back, and I said, well, I'm going to take a break and walk around. He said, here, put this on, and hand me a little badge that said chaplain on it, and said, you should wear this as you walk around. And I said, no, that's going to create some expectations that I don't feel I can do. And I handed it back at that point. But that's, I think, how I'm seeing these visible signs. So I've got expectations of you.
And we are thinking that buttons might be nicer than robes.
Just a little priest. I'm a priest. Ask me.
I'm a t-shirt.
A t-shirt.
Sure, cheaper.
Much cheaper.
Yeah. Sangha crew.
So there are a couple more people with hands.
I saw Laura and then Holly. Yeah.
I think somewhat related to Julie's sort of point and question is something that has come up for me. And over the years, among the people that I've learned the most from in this Sangha are Ray, Mike, and Bob, because they've all been so vocal about their struggles. And I've been incredibly grateful for the candor, truly, that, you know, the humor, yes, too, but also the candor about the kind of blood, sweat, and tears that goes along with sitting. And so in a way, to me, it's not at all surprising that you three that I have seen so vividly as my teachers, that you would now, have wanted to take this next step in your own lives. And I've also wondered whether it'll still be possible for you to share some of the real sort of down and dirty stuff that you have, or whether you feel that you have to, maybe people would think, wow, he's a priest? And this is a rhetorical question. Obviously, I don't expect an answer or anything. I think maybe foremost expressing my gratitude to you all. But also a little bit a concern for me, maybe a little bit of a loss.
Well, I think one of our, actually on our website, it talks about the conditions for becoming a priest, and one is about having fallen on your butt in public at least once before. And actually, we have a requirement every retreat that every priest or everyone in a role has to do that. Because I think, as you say, to me, one of the treasures of our Dharma is all of us speaking from the truth of the matter, not... I hope we don't get to some elevated place or imagine. Of course, we all do from time to time. Oh, I'm at that place now. But it vanishes, and I think part of our great intention is that priest, lay person, Dharma teacher, not Dharma teacher, the thing here is what's really happening. And as you say, that's the amazing thing. The gift we give each other is not our wisdom, but ourselves show up in the authenticity, and it's a great gift.
And this is something that I think all three of us and Josh really take to heart, that one of the hallmarks of Boundless Way is that we are imperfect beings transmitting the Dharma, and that we're not setting ourselves up as people who are saying someday you will be perfect like us. That would be really, and I think it really goes back to the insight that James had about himself. I can check anybody. That's the most dangerous thing. We talked about what the most painful thing was a couple of days ago from that koan. This is a really dangerous thing. So I actually had this image because the light is shining off of Mike's head right now. So do you see it? Oh my God! But you know, our some of us have shiny heads. But hopefully, the we're still just as human and just as complete as ever, and we do tend in my answer to Jeremy, where I was making all those different categories, you know, this and that. There are categories of people who show up as perfect, and there are people who show up out of their hearts, and we do tend to favor the latter and come down hard on the former, or you know, ignore them and hope they'll come to their senses.
That's why nobody pays attention to it.
That's right. So shiny. So I want to reassure you, speaking for the Teachers Council, that this is a very high value for us, and we know it's a stage. We've all gone through it. We call it Zen sickness. And it's a useful stage to go through, but it's a stage. So if you see it happening as a member of the Sangha, you want to point it out. You know, and you don't want to get caught if you can.
I don't necessarily expect it.
Yeah.
It's a concern I have for my own practice.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And to my Sangha members here, yeah, that I'll still get to hear their wisdom through their struggles.
And we hope so, too. We have the same concern. Not really about these guys, but, you know, about everybody.
Yeah. Two of them.
That's true. There's one exception. You know who it is.
Can I just respond a little bit to that? Is that the questions and concerns that you've all raised are, I can say these are the very concerns that we've, you know, considered ourselves, the separation, and seeing how, you know, in a culture where how priests tend to separate and tend to take on a different role. And so those are the things that, at least for myself, that I've really looked at closely and continue to struggle. One thing that Boundless Way has done for me is given me an opportunity to respond to a call, and it is trusting that call that makes all the other issues kind of workable. That fundamentally, it's a call to what? Don't know.
Who is it? Who is it? Who is it?
Thank you. Holly.
I can answer that for you, Ray. It's a call to being yourself. And what I wanted to say earlier was that when I took Jukai, it was a really scary process because I was making it public how I felt. And what I'm seeing with these creepy guys is even more than they already have. It's like, this is how I feel, you know? And it's very moving. And also, you know, I'm kind of uncomfortable with the publicness of, you know, of my emotions. And it's just... inspiring, you know, to see the possibilities. And, you know, I think I was thinking that it's less anonymous and it's more inclusive in a way, because it, I don't know, it invites something. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Can I say something?
Say something, William.
Okay. I just wanted to say that for me, I won't tell my whole story, but I did not want to ordain. I never wanted to ordain. I wanted to be a lay practitioner for my entire life. But James, as in his function as my teacher, asked me to ordain, and because I was in this place in my life at that point in my practice, I just bowed to everything he asked me to do. Luckily, he has very high standards ethically and morally. I want to reassure everybody.
Particularly Dave.
I want to reassure Dave. But in that act of surrendering to my teacher's ask, I discovered something about what it meant to be a priest for me that I'm just so grateful. I everything Ray said I could say. I don't understand what it means to be a priest. I don't understand any of this. But there was something in that surrendering that that was a big teaching for me. So I just want to bow in gratitude once again. Thank you.